Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks again, friends, as always, for listening to the NOLA Drinks Show this week. I appreciate it. Got a good show coming up for you here today. This time around, we have two, not just one, but two featured interviews for you. First of all, we're going to head over to Bar Francis, the very fine restaurant and bar there on Ferret Street, uptown, run by our good friends Mark and Candace Ladder, also the owners of Two Jags. And we're not talking about Bar Francis. We're just there at Bar Francis, even though it's a cool place and you should go check it out. But we're joined again by my guest that comes on from time to time, Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa. And very specifically, what we talk about in the first part of the interview with Jim is how wines from South Africa are really good choices for your holiday events and meals. Lots of variety there, lots of things to make people happy, some really good price points going on. So we talk about some pairing ideas and some other considerations that might want to make you take a look at South African wines when you're planning your wine list for all the to-dos that are happening here this month as we cruise into the heart of the holiday season. Then we're going to head over to the fine bar Public Belt, which is located inside the Hilton Riverside Hotel right there along the river. Go figure, the Hilton Riverside Hotel at 2 Poydras. And we are talking about the Revillon tradition. It's a really interesting Creole tradition that dates back about 170 or so years, give or take, where people would enjoy an overnight meal after going to midnight mass on Christmas or after later on in the evening in the early morning hours of New Year's Day. So we're talking about that, and we're joined by Karen Leatham, who is an historian at the Louisiana State Museum Group, and she shares a whole boatload of knowledge about the tradition, where it comes from, some misconceptions where people thought it was always private events in people's homes, but the whole restaurant angle in, you know, the early days of this going back. And then we are also talking with Heather Twitchell, who is the food and beverage manager for French Quarter Festivals Incorporated. And some years back, not too long ago, they reinvented the idea, if you will, of Revillon dinners. But now what they are, instead of being these overnight dinners that are really late at night, okay, there you go, tough for old people like me. All throughout the month of December, numerous dozens of restaurants around New Orleans have a four-course price-fixed meal for you to go check out. Some people are doing very traditional stuff, and we talk about that too, what some of the traditional menus look like back decades ago, but where you can go find a contemporary meal, a contemporary spin on the traditional stuff. Really cool. There's Revillon on the Rocks, which brings a cocktail angle into this, and we talk about that. One of the outfits participating with Revillon on the Rocks, of course, is the Public Belt Bar there at the Hilton Riverside Hotel. So we're also joined by Randy Peebs, who is the food and beverage director for the fine hotel there, the Hilton Riverside. So really interesting conversation about the Revillon tradition, both old and new. Then let's see, we continue our conversation. If you're listening on the radio, go get the podcast, your favorite podcast platform, or at noladrinks.com, because those guys stick around. We talk further about the Revillon tradition. And then Jim comes back, and this might be a little bit more for you folks in the industry, or if you're hardcore wine enthusiasts, sort of why wines from South Africa fit really well on wine lists. And again, talking about that variety, talking about that price point. So if you're into wines, even if you're not in the industry, you probably want to hear that, give you some really good knowledge when you're going out looking for some wines from South Africa and some great wines to stock up on for your wine drinking needs. Friends, want to mention really quickly here, a cool event for our friends in the hospitality industry coming up on December 7th, this Friday, from 1 to 3 p.m. at Courtyard Brewery, which is located at 1020 Erato Street, New Orleans. It is put on by our friends at 504 Healthcare. And what they're doing is they're doing a free flu shot drive. So if you're in the hospitality industry, this Friday between 1 and 3, go to Courtyard Brewery. You can get a free flu shot. There's also other things going on, information about personal wellness. I guess there's a massage chair going on, some raffle prizes, and some information on how you can get health insurance and health care if you're in the hospitality industry. Check that out. It's on our Facebook page. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drinks Show, and then I'm going to be back chatting with Jim Clark of Wines of South Africa, and then over to the Public Belt talking about Revillon. Come on back.
I'm going to take you out, girl, and spend some time. If I do, just one more round, I'm gonna take you out, darling, on the town.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening in this week. And you're hearing this sometime thereafter, but this week in particular, as we're doing the show, is South African Wine Week that we're celebrating here in New Orleans, the second iteration thereof. Pleased to welcome my friend Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa back to the show. Jim, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pleasure. And you were on with me, as listeners are hearing it, not too long ago. But this will be, as I said, heard a little bit later on. But I'm seeing you now, so there's some sort of time warp thing that's going to be happening here that I'm not qualified to talk about. But let's touch on this really quickly. We are in the midst of South African Wine Week, and by the time listeners are hearing it, as I said, it's over. But how's it going?
I think it's going great. I've been hearing great things from the restaurants and shops that have been involved. I've been stopping by some really creative pairings and just a great wide diversity of South African wines being shown this week. So
that's great. It's a really fun event. We're glad that second, hopefully annual. We'll see how that, but hopefully
I hope so too.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Good to have you down here. So what we're talking about, Jim, this time around is we are obviously in the midst of the holiday season, and we want to talk a little bit about, for listeners out there that are curious about South African wines and the diversity thereof, how they might kind of fit in that holiday, on that holiday table, both here in New Orleans, but I really think beyond.
Right.
I think we've got a lot of versatility and a lot of different things that we can look at.
I mean, there's... even the most planted variety, Chenin Blanc, is only 18% of South Africa's vineyards, so you do have a lot of different things to play with. So it's very handy that way. But I think one of the first things I encountered with the holidays, specifically regarding South African wines, is when I was a sommelier. You'd have a guest come in and say, hey, I've got 50 people coming in. I want to keep wine service simple. Let's do a white and a red. And I said, okay, well, let's do South African Chenin as your white. And they would usually kind of raise an eyebrow, and I would say, well, what happens if you serve Chardonnay? Well, some people love it.
Right.
And some people really don't like it. Same as Sauvignon Blanc. So what we found was with classic examples like Ken Forrester or the Clove Street or many South African Chenins have something, enough body for Chardonnay drinkers, enough aroma for the Sauvignon Blanc drinkers, and they're still fresh, which appeals to Pinot Grigio drinkers. So when you take those kind of three major white wine drinker types, you've got something for everybody in that. So you can serve that to a large group and make everyone happy.
You've got that nice little spot in the Venn diagram where fits everything really well. And you and I did a feature not too long ago that listeners can check out on the show. And also, we did an IGTV segment where you can actually look at us if you want to. And we talked about Chenin Blanc. And we touched on that, about it being such a versatile wine. I think one of the nice things, too, when we talk about the possibilities for the holidays, is there is a significant breadth of style as well as varietal. So maybe let's cut that way a little bit, Jim. Because we talked about Chenin previously,
but let's
touch on, because we haven't really done this too much before. What are some of the other varietals that we might want to look for? We know, and I'll just frame it really quickly this way before I throw it to you. Going back a couple decades or so, you know, it was a lot of mimicry, I think is the term that we used before, of French style, old world style, and those varietals,
right,
and those styles of blends. But now I think we're seeing other things come into the blending process as far as what people are using, right?
I mean, I think on the white side, you are seeing some Chenin-based blends, which uses, for the South Africans, Chenin is a warm climate variety, so it's not, we don't think of it like the way you think of in the Loire, where it's very high acid, but plant it somewhere warm and you can still keep good freshness with it. So they can blend that with Rhone varieties or other things. Chenin provides the spine, and the other varieties provide more texture and just flavor complexity.
Right.
But I think in general, with South African white wines, the excitement is in the texture. So if you have a Chardonnay, there's some wonderful Chardonnays from South Africa. It went from being not planted in South Africa in 1981 to being about 7.5%, almost 7.5% of their vineyards now. And many of them, you won't get a lot of that big oakiness, but you'll get this really pleasant, full mouthfeel, again, but keeping its freshness. That seems to be really unique to the way they're handling Chenin down there. There's a lot of Sauvignon Blanc, which usually, again, kind of... It's the stereotype of South African wines. A little bit older, a little bit new.
Right.
So a little bit Sancerre, a little bit New Zealand. So not as in your face as a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc might be, not as mineral as the Sancerre, but a little bit of both.
Yeah, that makes sense. And a lot of the ones that we've tasted before, you and I, together with the Sauvignons, I think that's spot on as far. It has, if you like that New Zealand style, you're going to find something in there.
Exactly.
Because there's a good backbone of acid in all of these. You get some bright fruit notes in all of these as well. But as opposed to, say, a Sancerre, it's got some of that minerality and got some of those other considerations that you would expect from that region.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the ones, too, that we had the opportunity to taste recently when we did a tasting here a couple weeks ago before South African Wine Week, I tasted a couple very nice expressions either using or single varietal Sansot.
Yeah. Sansot has a very interesting history in South Africa. At one point, it made up 75% of the red grapes that were planted back around 1900.
Oh, really? Okay.
And it was kind of a workhorse grape. It can be really prolific, and it's easy to grow. And a lot of times, people were trying to just using it as a blended grape, or then later they were trying to make a big, powerful wine out of it when Sansot has a thin skin and it's a juicy grape. So it actually lends itself to a lighter, fresher style.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing now is winemakers embracing that and making these reds that you might want to serve with a chill, sort of like a Beaujolais might appeal. So when you're looking for a lighter red, because you're going to be, maybe you have a long day of drinking ahead of you or something like that, it works really well that way. The other thing we're seeing, and this is also new, is a lot of the young winemakers today are tasting some of the so-called Cabernets from the late 60s and early 70s. And I say so-called because the laws in South Africa were such then that you could have 40% of a variety and label it by that variety.
Oh, I did not know that.
So
okay.
A Cabernet Sauvignon back then had to be at least 40%, but it's a lot lower than today when the minimum is 85%.
Right. Okay.
And that's not unique to South Africa. California rules were similarly lax.
Yep.
But anyhow, what they realize is that a lot of these so-called cabs were cabs and so blends. Reason was, one, I think the winemakers realized it made a good wine, but also the clones of Cabernet they had in South Africa produced really thin, really thick-skinned grapes. And the equipment they had at the time to pump things through the hoses couldn't handle it. It got too dense and it would get clogged. So by adding this thin-skinned, juicy grape, by actually just mixing it in the vats, it helped lubricate the system.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
That's
but
cool.
It ended up creating wines that people are drinking them now and saying, wow, this 1967 or this 1972 is incredible and has held up incredibly well for 50 years later.
That's really interesting. I'm a big fan of Sansot in general, so what it brings to a blender in that situation. I'd love to try some of these. But where would we say, Jim, things stand as far as percent of plantings these days with Sansot?
It's still very low. It's less than 2%.
Oh, it's that small.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the British magazine, I believe Trade Magazine, Drinks Business, published an article, I think 2 years ago, saying, is Sansot South Africa's Malbec? And that's really getting way ahead of things.
Right.
There's not enough for it to be the Malbec of anywhere right now.
Right. You got to find not even the Malbec of Cahors at this point.
But obviously it shows some enthusiasm for the grape, at least. Yeah,
it does perform really well, and some of the expressions that we tasted were really nice.
Yeah.
Now, let's move to Cab. I know we touched on this, but because we are seeing a lot of very nice Cabs that are coming we actually just had one, Sylvia and I, my wife, just 2 nights ago, the Mirlust.
Oh, yeah.
Cabernet.
Well, that's a classic. Yeah.
Really nice. And it also, I think, a good example of one, as you described, the Sansot and some of the other wines, or excuse me, the Sauvignon Blanc, sitting between the old world and the new. It had that earthiness that I would expect, say, from a Bordeaux. It was a very leathery, which was also, it was very enjoyable, and it like kind of right in the middle. And it had character. It was fairly bold, but it was not over the top by any stretch. But it was a cab.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing from a lot of them these days is you see that it's old world, new world, maybe a little bit new world on the nose, old world on the palate.
Yeah,
and that can be really great, because if you're used to drinking California cab, which are wonderful, I'm not disparaging them, but from a food pairing view, sometimes they can be a little bit overly lush on the palate.
Mm.
So if you like that aroma, you can have a South African cab, get that aroma, but then you have a little bit more tan, a little bit more structure on the palate, which makes it a little bit more food friendly, a little bit more food flexible.
I really liked that wine. There was a nice acidity to it as well on things. And I can't remember. I think we just drank it. I don't think we ate anything with it. Got into the bottle.
You can still do that. That's okay.
That seems to happen quite a bit in our house.
Yep.
Anyway, and so let's talk about this one, Jim, that we're tasting now here. This is Stony Brook, and it's a blend of Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, so that classic sort of Bordeaux white style in composition anyway.
Exactly. And again, going sort of like talking about the history of Sansot, back when Sansot was the dominant red, at that point, 90% of their vineyards, this is around 1890, 1900, were actually Semillon. So there's a long history of Semillon in South Africa. And it faded. It was kind of, as Chenin Blanc rose, Semillon kind of faded into the background. But there's a lot of really excellent old vine vineyards of Semillon floating around.
Okay.
And a lot of producers, whether this, the one we're drinking, I think, I don't know what the blend is. I think it's around 60-40.
That would be my guess, somewhere in that ballpark.
And so it's really going for that white Bordeaux style. Mm-hmm. But even in the Sauvignon Blanc producers who are making, you know, a varietal Sauvignon Blanc, sometimes they'll use a bit of Semillon, you know, 5-10%, just to add that mid palate.
Yep.
So you get that wonderful textural character. Again, that's something that I think South African winemakers really prioritize in their white wines is texture.
Is texture.
And Semillon is such a great tool when you want to create firmness in the palate.
I agree entirely. And I think this one's nice. And just so we're clear, when we're saying 60-40, we're guessing 60 Sauvignon Blanc, 40 Semillon.
Right.
One of the things that, and Jim, you and I were talking about this right before we went on the air, one of the things that Semillon, always does that I really like is it brings this kind of, besides the texture and mouthfeel, a sort of hay note. And it kind of can round out a little bit if you're getting that bright fruit up front and then you're getting that bracing acidity. And as you said, in the mid-palate, it brings an earthy kind of hay note that's very pleasant to
hay,
the wine.
Hay and kind of a beeswax or, I mean, this there is now 2013, so it's got 5 years of that honey wax, that beeswax developing almost into a little bit of a honey sort of character.
Right.
Yeah.
This is a really nice expression of this. And so what we're talking about here, friends, I think if you're gathering, is we hit on some varietals and we hit on some different things as far as stylistically goes. Great amount of diversity that's going to work with a great diversity of foods and on your holiday table. And I don't want to flog that horse too much, but that's what you can really find a lot of stuff that's going to make people happy. But when we talk about different styles, however you go about the cuisine that you cook, whether you're doing a turkey or whether you're doing something that's more Creole like we do down here in New Orleans, you're going to be able to find something among South African wines that's going to fit the mold.
Yeah. Well, looking, I mean, here we're at Bar Francis participating in the Wine Week, and they've got for whites, so they've got a Chenin, a Chardonnay, and this Semillon Sauvignon Blanc blend. Those are all representative. I mean, it's not going out. None of these are out of left field wines for South Africa. So they all kind of are part of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Same with the reds. You have two Rhone style blends and then a Pinot Noir. I mean, they could have, if they wanted to, one of those could have been a Bordeaux style blend or a Cab, and that still would have been typically South African. So it doesn't matter what kind of wine you like. There's something that South Africa's going to make that you're going to enjoy.
Yeah, so. I think that's a great point. And you know, and what we would recommend to people, obviously, is you know, go to your local retailer, and especially if you're familiar with somebody that carry South African wines, and if they don't, you should ask them why they don't.
Absolutely.
but beyond that, you know, ask for some guidance, because there's something out there for you to find in this world of South African wines. And you know, if it's a little confusing or it's new to you, you know, ask for some advice. Where else can people go to read up, Jim, say if they want to do some research on their own for what they're looking for among wines of South Africa?
Well, I think our website is a great resource. I wouldn't, quite frankly, don't go to the U.S. website, but go to our head office website, which is wosa.co.za. So that's co, like commercial, like .com. The ZA is Zuid Afrika, because it's Afrikaans. And so it's not South Africa, it's Zuid with a Z.
Yeah, if you do .sa, you're going to find something somewhere else. You're going to be in a different country.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot of really, really good resources there. One of the things I think is really cool about the website as well is there's maps.
Absolutely.
Which I like geeking on wine maps, and so that there's a good thing, and a lot of breakdown of style and some other considerations. I don't recall this part, Jim. Can people find links to some of the wineries then, so you can get into, say, finding the tech sheets and things like that for the different wines
there's
from there?
I believe there's a list of all the WOSA Wines of South Africa member wineries on there as well, so with links. Yeah.
And I know a lot of the wineries there are pretty savvy to this. I know it's always hit or miss with any area when you're grouping wineries in, but you can generally find information from the wineries themselves. Find the one page, we call them tech sheets in the industry, that'll tell you what's in the wines, some of the élevage, how it's made.
They're generally pretty good about that. And, you know, even though for a lot of winemakers, really their native language would be Afrikaans, all the websites are in English. So you're going to, you know, you don't have to like click through to find the English content or something like that. It's all going to be right up front.
Yeah, I notice when I do Google Translate, wine terms don't necessarily come out too well.
Not too good. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, Jim, you're going to stick around. We're going to do another segment here coming up in a bit on talking about South African wines and how they work really well. If you're in the industry or you're an enthusiast, how they work really well on wine lists. So friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
Oyster rake scraping down Grand Highway.
by Joe, I got to go.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Hey, thanks for listening to the show today, friends, as always. And we are here at the Hilton Riverside Inn in their cool bar here on the second floor of the Public Belt. And I am pleased to be joined by a food and beverage director here at the hotel, Randy Peebs. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also my good pal, Heather Twitchell, food and beverage manager for French Quarter Festivals Incorporated.
Hello.
Hi, Heather. How are you?
Hi. I'm wonderful.
Great. Good to see you back.
Thank you.
Great to have you on. And so what we're doing here, folks, is, you know, if you're listening at the top of the show, and I hope you were, we're talking about the Revillon tradition. We're going to have Karen on, who's an historian, just in a little bit. But let's talk a little bit now, you guys, about Revillon. What's happening? It goes back to the 19th century, and we'll get into that with Karen. But let's talk a little bit, Heather, about what you are up to at French Quarter Festival, some of the cool things with the dinners and the cocktails and all the fun fandango.
Sure. So the Revillon tradition was revived in New Orleans in the late 80s, early 90s, because believe it or not, apparently December used to be like a dead month. Nothing happened.
A time for reflection.
Yes. So to build tourism, we started doing, one of the components we added was Revillon. And it has grown over the years. Now, Revillon has four components. We have a Revillon dinner. You can have a traditional Creole dinner or a more contemporary dinner if the chef is a little bit more creative. We also have Revillon on the Rocks for locations that maybe just have a bar outlet but still want to participate in the festivities of the season. This year, we added Petite Revillon.
Okay.
So that is an offering for guests that might want to stop at a bar, have some small plates, maybe not indulge in a full dinner, but still have the Revillon experience. Mm-hmm. And then we also have Brevillon, because that was the only clever thing I could come up with.
Thank God it's radio. You'd see the look on my face, but go on.
For a brunch version of Revillon.
Okay.
Because I love brunch, and I thought that was a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's an opportunity, Heather, for people to go experience various venues around town and go do like a price-fixed
Precisely.
Meal, right?
The Revillon dinners are four-course meals. The brunches are three courses. The petite Revillons are four small plates, and then the Revillon on the Rocks are just sort of like these specialty cocktails that come around for December and for the holidays.
Okay, gotcha. Now, Randy, here at the Hilton Riverside and Public Belt, you guys are doing a cocktail here in the bar, right, for Revillon on the Rocks?
Correct, we are. We do. We're doing. We wanted to kind of team up with a local distillery, do something cool and fun. Keep it holiday and a little funky. So we are working with Old New Orleans.
Rum.
Yeah. Rum.
Yeah.
We're using their Cajun spice rum with a little bit of gingerbread schnapps, Bailey's, and some gingerbread seasoning. So, you know, a real easy drinking, fun holiday cocktail.
Yeah. Now, can people come here into the Public Belt and get that throughout the month of December?
Correct.
Is that how that works?
We'll be running that all month long as our specialty cocktail.
Okay, that sounds like fun.
Yes.
Now, are you guys doing any other programming here connected to Revillon, or are you focusing on the cocktail this time?
We're really focusing on the cocktail.
Okay.
This time around.
They do have Papa Noel hotel rates.
Oh, okay.
Yes, so, discounted rates.
So people want to book a room here in December, you can do that. We'll Brooke's sitting over here, the marketing person. We'll get that information. We'll share it online. How's that sound? Okay, great. So tell us a little bit about, Randy, the Public Belt Bar here. How just about the space and kind of what you do.
Sure. This is really our, it's kind of our throwback bar, Prohibition-style bar. A lot of classic New Orleans cocktails. Focus on craft cocktails, really. And we do live entertainment nightly. So we'll have either a piano or a three-piece playing. Easy, you know, laid-back cocktail lounge with some really nice specialty cocktails.
That's great. So it's on the second floor here in the hotel.
Second floor in the hotel.
What are the hours here when people can come and join
themselves? We're open from 4 to 2.
Okay, great. Excellent. And Heather, with
in regards to getting folks on board, let's talk about Revion on the Rocks for a bit, because we started with Revion dinners a few years ago.
Yeah.
And then Revion on the Rocks was kind of the new thing of taking advantage of the cocktail scene, like these guys here at the Public Belt.
Yes.
And so how's that kind of working? Are you guys going out and recruiting different bars and bartenders and
generally
kind of let them do what they want with the drinks?
Yes, we kind of let them do what they want. I like to reach out. A lot of hotel bars, I think, are good options, just because they're having guests in town that maybe want something a little bit extra special. So a lot of the hotel bars, like Carousel, the Hotel Monteleone, the Ritz has one. But then other spots, like, do you know the Cafe Beignet that's on Decatur?
Yes, I do.
They have a drink called the, what is it called? The Mississippi Mudslide.
Okay.
And it's a frozen drink. Bailey's, Cathead Vodka, coffee liqueur, milk, whipped cream, and a chocolate drizzle. So it's like a delicious chocolate shake.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
With some lovely booze in it.
Yeah.
So we got a couple minutes, 3-4 minutes left before we take a break. Tell people about the concerts, Heather, real quick, that y'all are doing.
Oh, my gosh. So the concerts, we have been hosting concerts at St. Louis Cathedral for years and years. A few years ago, we added a series at St. Augustine Church in Treme on Saturdays. And let's see who we have. This year we have performing Rachel Van Voorhees. I mean, you can't have Christmas without a harpist, correct? But we also have the Iguanas performing,
yeah,
which
I am
today. Super excited about. I'm trying to find my schedule here. Here we go. Then we also have Lyle Henderson and Emmanuel. We have Shannon Powell, Topsy Chapman, Shades of Praise. Have you ever seen them?
No, I have not.
They're incredible.
Okay.
You have to come check them out.
Well, you can tell people where to find the list of everybody, because you got a whole bunch of acts.
I do. We have a lot. Yeah. So go to followyourjoy.com.
Followyourjoy.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the Revion tradition stuff.
Sure.
Randy, do me a favor. Tell people, what's the address here of the hotel? And tell us just very briefly, like, some of the other food and beverage programming that you got going
sure.
on here.
We're located at 2 Poitras Street, right downtown Central Business District. Public Belt, of course, on the second floor. But really, you know, in Public Belt, a lot of the classic cocktails we're doing, we're also going to be partnering up with a number of local vendors, whether distilleries, breweries, and whatnot, to mm-hmm. really put a focus on not only our craft cocktails that we're doing, but a local influence on our craft cocktails as well.
That's great.
And then reaching out for some regional stuff and kind of getting into some of the niche cool elements that are out there for cocktails, a little bit beyond the standard fare that you're going to get in a normal cocktail bar.
Okay, great. And people can just go find Hilton.com and then search for Hilton Riverside or New Orleans, right?
Yep.
And they're going to turn up that way. Okay, excellent. And tell people, Heather, where we can find and connect. We said Follow Your Joy for the programming going on with the holiday stuff, but what about for French Quarter Festival, where we find information out about there?
FQFI.org. That's F as in French, Q for quarter, F for festivals, I for Inc. .org.
Inc. for Incorporated. Okay, mm-hmm. very good. And what are the dates of French Quarter Festival this year?
Oh,
I don't want to get ahead of
April
11th
through the 14th.
Okay.
I already started working on food vendors for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. Well, here's what we're going to do, friends. We're going to take a little break here on the show, and then we're going to be back, and we're going to be joined by an historian who's going to talk about the history and tradition of Revion here in New Orleans, and we'll chat a little bit more about some of the programming and things like that going on. So, friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
Been down to New Orleans, then you can understand just what I mean. Now all through the week it's quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night they go from house to house. You don't have to pay the usual admission if you're a cook or a waiter or a good musician. So if you happen to be just passing by, stop in at the Saturday night fish fry. It was rocking, it was rocking. You never seen such scuffling and shuffling till the break of dawn. It was rocking, it was rocking. You never seen such scuffling and shuffling till the break of dawn. Now my buddy and me was on the main stem.
Well, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Well, I'm standing on a corner with the bucket in my hand. I'm just looking for a woman that ain't got no man. My bucket's got a hole in it. Yeah, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Yes, I went up on a mountain. I looked down on the sea. I seen the crabs and the fish.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the program. Brian D is here with you. Thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show this week. As always, and as promised, we are joined by an historian from the Louisiana State Museum, Karen Leatham. Karen, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for taking some time. I really appreciate it. And so what we talked a little bit in the first segment here about kind of what's happening these days with Revion and how it's been reinvented and cool stuff going on. But why you're here today is you're going to share us a little bit of an overview of the Creole tradition, I think, correctly, right? And that, and going back to France before that.
Right.
And just give us a little bit of an overview and story of where this Revion tradition comes from, what it means, how it happens.
Okay, I think most people who are familiar with today's Revion tradition will know, oh, it's something that people used to do after midnight mass. They go back home and have this big feast. And we all think about it now and we think, oh, I could never do that. We all want to go home and go to bed if we even go to midnight mass.
Right.
So it is something that people think about as this old ancient tradition, and then we know it now in its reinvented form from French Quarter festivals. And you're right to say that it was known as an old Creole tradition, and as many of those traditions, it went back to France. But the tradition is not as old as you might think.
Okay. So this isn't something that was started in France centuries ago and then was brought here.
Right. It's a product of sort of many centuries of Christmas traditions where, all over the Western world to celebrate Christmas, people would have all of these various feasts. But something called a Revion, the word Revion, really only dates back to the late 19th century. And the late 19th century, of course, was the time when many of our Christmas traditions were invented.
Mm-hmm.
The Christmas tree, Christmas cards, that sort of thing. It was the creation of the modern Christmas. And really, Revion, while it has roots in sort of midwinter feasting traditions, really dates back to that time. And in France, people would have Revion celebrations in their home, the way we tell the origin tale of New Orleans Revion. But they also had a very public Revion, just as we do now. And that's something that was a little unexpected for me when I first started doing research on this. I thought I would trace something that went from private to public. But private and public kind of happened at the same time.
Okay.
And Revion in Paris, for example, in the late 19th century, was almost like a progressive dinner party. Working-class Parisians would save for weeks and months to be able to afford to do this, and they would go have their first course, which was usually oysters, at one place, and then they'd move on to another restaurant. They'd have another course, and they'd go from place to place all night long.
And so this was more restaurant-driven.
So
that tradition has existed for a long time, just as you're saying, sitting in people's houses where you're invited over after Mass to eat.
Right.
Now, is it also correct, because a couple questions. I read things a couple different ways, because we have a lot of listeners from outside the area on the podcast, so they're probably going to, to a degree, what are we talking about? The idea with the verb in French, some people will translate it awaken, and some people will translate it as wake. There's not really a religious context to it other than you've come from Mass, maybe you feast or fasted during the day on Christmas Eve.
Right, has more to do with social connotations. And for any of your listeners who might be from Cajun country, they might know the word veille.
Yeah, okay.
Which is to visit with your family or friends. And it's a social gathering. And there are differing opinions on exactly where the term réveillon comes from, but some people do think that it comes more from this social meaning of veille. Now, they all have the same root,
Sure.
in French, but and so I'll go with the more social meaning.
That sounds good, because I hear people, like, and what I'm getting at, well, people will kind of explain it two different ways. One where it's sort of the, I guess we'll say, like, the secular, where it's awake. Well, you're up overnight, right, eating after mass or something, and you're awake. And then, but if you kind of apply that term awakening to it, some might think that it has a religious connotation to it. Really.
Well, here's the religious connotation, though. So you're eating after mass, and you're thinking, well, it's the capstone to your night. But in truth, it's when you break the fast that you had to have before mass. We forget about all that fasting because we don't do very much of it anymore. If people who are Catholic do this, they do it once a year.
That's more
or twice
to,
a year.
And stuff and Mardi Gras,
right? But they would fast on Christmas Eve, except, you know, those exceptions like pregnant women or small children. But so you were breaking your fast. And so you really were hungry and interested in eating at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, and that's kind of what drives it, right? We're not talking about there was some sort of religious ceremony aspect to it. It's like, fast is over and I'm going
to
eat.
Yeah, no, it's time to party.
Right. There it is. Now, tell me a little bit too, Karen, if you would, about, because we obviously strongly associate it with Christmas, but then the tradition of it being, of it happening after New Year's is kind of, took hold at a period of time.
Yes,
correct?
Yes. It's also a part of New Year's celebrations, and it carries that meaning very strongly still in France today. But also it carried that meaning in New Orleans. What I've seen is not so much this commercial Réveillon going on for Christmas, but it happens for New Year's. And you see early 20th century New Orleans advertisements for Réveillon for New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it would start maybe at 10 and end at 2 in the morning.
Okay.
So, again, sort of in that late night tradition.
Got it. So when with the Christmas tradition and the New Year's tradition, did they kind of emerge at the same time here in New Orleans anyway? Were people just sort of like looking to have a late night meal because when we get out of mass on Christmas, so that's a good reason, right? And then on New Year's Eve, you're kind of up late and it's New Year's, so that's a good reason.
They were really building on earlier New Year's traditions.
Okay.
You may know that the guys who started Comas got their start in Mobile, making a lot of noise on New Year's Eve. That sort of tradition. And that kind of ties into Réveillon and midwinter traditions too. All over Europe, people would go around in places like England and Ireland. They would be what they call mumming. They would be in costume, and they go from house to house and get food and drink. A little like rural Mardi Gras in Louisiana, where you go around and gather your ingredients for gumbo. So there are all these winter traditions that kind of meld together and feed into Christmas and Réveillon.
Okay. Another question, too, and we got about a minute and a half, 2 minutes, you guys, before we close out the radio portion of the show. I think a lot of people think and associate the traditional aspect of this as these large, decadent meals after Mass and, or, you know, New Year's Eve. But I think in a lot of cases, a lot of people celebrated, you mentioned this, all the way down to the working class. So a lot of times, if I'm not mistaken, these meals were much more simple. They weren't these huge parties and extravaganzas. People were just enjoying a well-prepared, home-prepared meal.
Right, right. And often meals that could be prepared beforehand and sit on the table while you went to Mass and come back. And so, you know, you might have turkey, and turkey was often very popular, but you'd have all sorts of sweets and sweet, not sweet breads, one word, but two words, sweet breads, yeast breads. and you would have dough glacé, the masterpiece of New Orleans that sort of has made a comeback in recent years.
Yeah.
But
tell people what that is. Yeah.
It's meat in aspic. It's like jellied meat.
Jellied meat.
Which is much more delicious than it sounds.
Dove glacé does sound better than the jellied
meat. Yeah, right? It sounds much better, much fancier. And I think there are a few restaurants offering that this year.
There are.
So, yeah, Heather, let me ask you that because we got about a minute left. But the chefs these days, when they're doing the stuff, they can either take it to the classic direction or kind of the way it started, though, right? You encourage them to do the classic thing?
Yes, it started with the traditional Réveillon. And sort of as time progressed, we realized that more contemporary chefs weren't necessarily wanting to do a more traditional dish. So we added the contemporary category where chefs can be more creative, sort of more on trend, and aren't necessarily held to more stringent, you know, Creole tradition standards of what would be okay. available in the, you know, late 1800s in New Orleans.
Awesome. Great, you guys. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to close out the radio portion of the show, friends, now. And if you should want to, and I think you should, stick around for the podcast. You can go get it on your favorite podcast platform or check out NolaDrinks.com. These three are going to continue to join us. We're going to chat a little bit more about the tradition of Revillon and some other cool stuff. And I'll also be back with Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa. So, friends, remember to be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all. Everybody, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you as always. Hope you enjoy and are enjoying the conversation we are having with Randy, Heather, and Karen talking about the Revillon tradition. We're going to bounce right back over to the Public Belt Bar here in just a second and continue that conversation with those guys. And then Jim Clark, who we chatted with at the top of the show, as you know, will rejoin us talking about South African wines and how they are a good fit on the wine list, kind of coming from a restaurant angle or wine bar angle, beverage program angle. But if you're a wine enthusiast and you're looking for some good insight on why South African wines are just good to have for your events, for your celebrations, or just have on, you know, in your wine fridge or on your wine shelf, it's you'll find some information there too. So it isn't just for folks in the industry. So we're going to do that. After those two interviews, I'll be back with my parting shot. Here we go. All right, everybody, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. And we are here at the Public Belt Bar in the Hilton Riverside Hotel to Poydras here in downtown New Orleans. And we're talking about the Revillon tradition, friends. I'm pleased to be joined here on our podcast only portion. Randy Peebs, who is the food and beverage director, stuck around. Randy, how you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for hosting, man. I appreciate it. Heather Twitchell, my pal, food and beverage manager
Hi.
From French Quarter Festival. Hey, how you doing?
Good. Still Good. Here.
You're still here, too, hanging around. And Karen Leatham, who is an historian at Louisiana State Museum. Karen, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So it was kind of fun. We closed out the radio portion, and we were talking a little bit during the break and chatting about the tradition of Revillon. And I think, you know, a lot of people, especially if you're listening outside the area, maybe you know some of these Catholic traditions because you know you're familiar with them because you live them or whatever. They're not foreign to you, and then you kind of combine that with maybe how you view Mardi Gras and this sort of idea where it's like this big party and there's a lot of revelry and rowdiness and so on and so forth that leads up to this period of Lent and then this austere period in your life. But when we're talking about Revillon here, that you know we touched on this a little bit, but the idea that you know this wasn't necessarily like an all-out party after you got out of Mass or on New Year's Eve. It was just kind of like get together, have a meal, have some friends over, maybe have a little wine. Is that right, Karen?
Right. It was gather with the people you know and have a nice meal. In some cases, somewhat elaborate, but you had to have things that were prepared beforehand. And so you would come back from Mass and have the spread all ready to go. So you couldn't be, you know, heating things up at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
So it tended to focus on things that didn't have to be heated.
Okay. Now, we were talking, too, about this idea of, you know, Christmas Eve traditionally, at least in the Catholic tradition here, being a period of fasting, and even some of the, I think some of the times in the weeks in December leading up were not necessarily party times, like going to holiday parties left and right like we do now. It was more of a time of reflection, I think, and some other things.
Right.
And then we get to this, you know, this idea, okay, we come out of Mass and we have a Réveillon dinner. But you were talking about some things during the break, Karen, with there was a lot of public angle to this, and you were talking about an image in Harper's of people on Christmas Eve. They weren't fasting. They were actually out having a good time and shooting off fireworks on Canal.
Right. Canal was just this hub of activity on Christmas Eve, and this image I mentioned shows people walking down the sidewalk, and they have all these packages in their hands. Maybe they're going to, you know, give Christmas gifts. Children running around, setting off fireworks, and it is a pretty boisterous looking scene.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of glad that that's not happening right now with children setting off fireworks on Canal Street on Christmas Eve.
Safe and sane.
Yes, right. Thank you. Let's not do that yet.
Well, Randy, let me ask you this question, because you recently relocated, not all that long ago, from Maryland here.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, you come down here and you come to New Orleans, and we're talking about Réveillon, some of these other things. Obviously, what is your take on all of these kind of interesting traditions that we have, and then some of this modern flip that we do on a lot of this stuff?
It's interesting. I never really heard it referred to as Réveillon before. I mean, even growing up, I grew up in a Catholic family in upstate New York.
Okay.
That was our tradition, was Christmas Eve was, we started around noon, and each hour we were creating a different seafood dish. So we didn't eat meat. We didn't eat any kind of meat product all day except for seafood.
Italian, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And then we would go to midnight Mass, and then we'd come back from midnight Mass, and we'd have a giant prime rib and wine, and like we were up late. Christmas began to be something where it was more of a recovery day, right?
Yeah.
Not necessarily all the booze, but you know, there was a little bit of that as we got older. But it was just kind of, it was almost like Thanksgiving. It's like you spend the next day just kind of
laying
around it. But it was very much a social gathering, relatives coming over, stopping by throughout the day, and you know, just great time to spend time together. So, hearing it now down here, and it referred to as Réveillon, and it's very similar, but you know, just slightly different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're talking about the Creole tradition here, I think, which obviously we're touching on some other things where people, you know, are from other ethnicities and things. Well, technically Italian as well here. There's some different things that go on here, right, Karen?
Right. And one similarity, though, is this tendency to treat Christmas Day as some kind of afterthought. The real thing was the Réveillon night, and the next day was not such a big deal. This practice of gift-giving, people gave gifts, but it's not in the same way that we do now. And for a lot of families of French descent, the gifts would come really for New Year's instead of Christmas. So
kids would just get maybe sweets and stuff, right?
Simple that stuff. Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Heather, because you grew up here, so, you know,
for the most part, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For the most part. So with your sort of Christmas tradition, how did you grow up then? And New Year's, like just your holiday tradition.
Midnight Mass. I remember falling asleep in Midnight Mass many times. But we would do dinner before Mass, then kind of like power nap, and then Midnight Mass. And then I would be the first one awake on Christmas morning to go officially unwrap all the presents that I had kind of already secretly unwrapped. That was your sneaky one.
Yeah, and I'll be very brief. In my case, I grew up in Northern California, and there, right near my house, was one of the California Dominican missions that, you know, came up the coast as the Mexicans came up and mm-hmm. Franciscans, and settled the coastline there. And there was a bar across the street from St. Joseph's. And it was the Mission Bell Tavern, which is the bar that I quote unquote grew up in.
Uh-huh.
Take that for what it is. And everybody, you know, would ostensibly be going to the younger folks in the family that are my age would be going to Mass at the Catholic Church across the street. It was amazing to see how many people were actually in the bar, how many people actually went to the bar, then went to Mass, how many people never left the bar,
right?
Or how many people just told their parents they were going to midnight Mass and just didn't go at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was an interesting social observation to me because I wasn't participating in any of it, just counting heads, really. But let's talk about this, Karen, because we were talking about this interesting tradition. I think you said this before. It wasn't just a private thing. There was a public face to this as well. But we see this tradition kind of die out here in New Orleans, it seems, by maybe the 1920s, 1930s. And is this sort of connected to that modern conception of Christmas and commercialization?
Yeah,
and things
I think
like that?
So. I think, you know, New Orleanians adopt the American Christmas. But in the 20s and 30s, they're still talking about the old traditions. And part of that is from, you know, the WPA writers under the New Deal, going around and taking oral histories and recording people's stories and talking to people. And so a lot of reminiscing about the old days. And this is also the time when New Orleans is a French newspaper, the B, La Baie in French. It stops publication in 1925. And so I think there's this sense of a passing of an era. And so there's a lot of reminiscing going on in the newspaper and then through the WPA to document the old ways. Okay. So they're talking about it, but not celebrating it so much anymore. They're talking about it as a past thing.
Okay. And with the restaurant tradition, then, I think this has some effect on this as well, right? We kind of see the rise of a lot of restaurants in New Orleans in the early 20th century.
Right.
I mean, there's obviously something to go back further, as we know, but I think that's when it became more popular. Is that correct to say? And people then started going out more for holidays to eat. And things.
Yeah, particularly, I would say, sort of 1950s on, where dining out becomes a more regular practice rather than this, you know, once a year treat or something among sort of middle class and working class people.
Got it.
So,
yeah. So let me, one last question on the tradition as well. We'll circle back there, but tell people where they can connect with more information. You know, we talk about these sort of different, in the private scope of Réveillon dinners, right, where this wasn't just rich people doing these big meals. It was also working class people would do this. And I remember reading somewhere, and I'm forgetting where, I apologize, that sort of talking about, let's not forget that especially certain people of a certain stature and wealth would be able to host maybe larger meals, more decadent meals. And they were actually people working. We want to make sure we remember people had servants and these sorts of things. And there's a class of people that were actually working during this time, and not just everybody was off eating meals and having a good time.
Somebody had to cook that jellied meat.
Somebody had to cook the jellied meat, right? Because you were talking about earlier that, like, things that would be prepared in advance, right? So I'm guessing, like, if you're a working class family, you tried to prep things in advance as much as possible because that was your option.
Right.
But if you were a richer family, you maybe had people working for you that you came home to a freshly cooked hot meal, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Tell us a story really quickly about the turkeys, because I like this.
Okay. Turkeys, as in many places, turkeys were really important for the holidays in New Orleans, and they would sell them live. And there used to be men driving a herd of turkeys down Barone Street. I would like to have seen that.
Yeah.
And then you could go get your turkey at the French market. But the idea was you would buy your turkey and then put it in a pen in your backyard and feed it and fatten it up for 2-3 weeks. And there's one account in this late 19th century where this goes on for about 3 days, stories in the paper about somebody's turkey being stolen, like, just before Christmas.
Wow.
So they've been feeding this turkey and saying, okay, we're going to have this turkey, and then the turkey's gone. And, of course, they never find the person who stole the turkey.
Right, okay. Then that's what we were laughing about. That's contemporary New Orleans that I know.
Right.
Yeah.
Stealing your Amazon gifts off your porch.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Taking the turkey from the backyard.
Well, Heather, do me a favor. Remind people where they can find out information about the Réveillon programming going on in this day and age and this particular month this
currently,
year.
Currently.
Yes.
Followyourjoy.com. And also, I just wanted to touch on the price points you were talking about.
Oh, please,
sort of. They start around $38. You can go all the way up to $100. Some of them have wine pairings. But check them out. They have some really great offerings. It's a great way to sample the cuisine and try out a new restaurant in the city. A lot of people actually kind of make a list. They'll go through and they'll do their, like, a Réveillon a week list.
Yeah, because there's a lot of classic restaurants that are participating. There's a lot of new folks that are participating. Mm-hmm. How many restaurants are there, roughly?
60 total, and there's 17 new locations this year. Longway is a new one. Mo Bar came on. GW Finn's is back. They haven't been participating in a while, but they're back this year. Brennan's is back.
Okay.
Classic Brunch. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah. Awesome.
Good flavors.
Randy, do me a favor to remind people again where they find the hotel here in Public Bell, especially, you know, for our out-of-town listeners, you know, if they want to come visit New Orleans, this is a pretty good place to stay. Get
oh,
a good
absolutely.
Drink. Got to get a good room. It's, good location.
It's located at 2 Poydras Street, Hilton Riverside. Not only do we have a great bar here in Public Belt, but we also have our Drago's seafood restaurant downstairs, our Spirits lobby bar. And, you know, with this Revillon cocktail that we're promoting this year, we're also partnering with the Children's Hospital. So we have a package available at the hotel. When you book a stay, you do get a complimentary cocktail, and we do make a donation to the Children's Hospital
as
well.
Really cool. Okay.
So it's a really cool aspect, you know, get to have a great cocktail and do some good with it as well.
A good cause.
Correct.
I like it. Thank you, Randy. I appreciate that. Karen, do me a favor. Tell people where they can find find you there at the Louisiana State Museum. Maybe not you personally, but what's the website for the museum? Do you know off the top of your head? You can just Google Louisiana State Museum, right? It's going to come up. And you mentioned there are nine...
LouisianaStateMuseum.org.
Okay, there we go. And you mentioned that you guys actually have nine...
Nine museums.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We have the Presbyterian, the Cabildo, the Old U.S. Mint, which is now the New Orleans Jazz Museum. Yep. Madame John's Legacy, which is currently closed to the public, but we have plans for reopening that soon.
Okay.
In a year or more. And the 1850 House, which is in the Lower Pontalba Building.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the Capitol Park Museum in Baton Rouge, which is a big building full of exhibits. And if people haven't been there, they should go visit. Also, the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame and Northwest Louisiana History Museum in Natchitoches.
Okay, yeah.
So speaking of Christmas, they can go see that and see the Christmas lights in Natchitoches. And also the E.D. White House in Thibodeau, and the Waddell Williams Aviation and Cypress Sawmill Museum in Patterson.
Awesome. Wow. All at LouisianaStateMuseum.org, friends. You don't have to recite all that back to us if you're listening. Thanks, you three. I really appreciate you taking some time, and thanks again, Randy, for hosting us here today at Public Belt. I appreciate it. Friends, we're going to sign off briefly here, take a brief musical interlude, and I'll be back chatting with Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa. All right, everybody. Yep, we're sitting here with Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa, and we are talking about South African wines. Go figure, it works out really well that way. And one of the things that we want to talk about here today, Jim, we talked a little bit before about different varietals and how there's a great amount of versatility and other things going on with South African wines. But as we speak to maybe hardcore enthusiasts who would be interested in this, but people who are in the industry, a lot to be found in this regard as well if you're putting together a wine list in a restaurant or a wine bar.
Absolutely. I think already in other conversations we've touched on the versatility of Chenin and who that can appeal to.
Sure.
But I think one of the things to remember with South African wines, especially, you know, partially as a function of the exchange rate, but that really competitive $15 to $20 price range is really one of the places where South Africa is really performing the best. A lot of our best domestic wines have moved up out of that price range, or then you've got all the kind of mass market stuff happening around, you know, $10. Whereas if you want, you know, something you're going to have for a $15 or, you know, depending on the maybe, you know, $14 or even $13 by the glass, it's hard to find something that's quality domestically. And South Africa is often stepping into that gap. You know, mm-hmm. I can show you a number of, you know, familiar varieties. We're talking about like a Cabernet or something like that. That'll come in at that price point and really shine in a way that domestic wines have a hard time doing. Just from a financial point
of
view.
From a cost perspective.
Yeah, from a cost perspective.
I think this is a great point, Jim, because when we're looking around, and if you're looking around for wines that are in a price point that is, as you said, $15 to $20, there is a wealth of stuff that can be found there of high quality.
Yeah.
And that puts it in situations where you might be able to compare to, say, some South American wines and some things like that along those lines, even New Zealand wines to a degree. But what we're also, I think, seeing is that we're seeing something then, because of, by virtue of this, really, if you're looking to build something by the glass, that puts it firmly in that price point then.
Exactly. And I think Cabernet is a great example. Chardonnay, obviously, Sauvignon Blanc. So these are familiar varieties. So maybe you've got a touch of exotic on your list now because you have South Africa, but it's not like going with Georgian wines where people aren't even sure where Georgia is, at least Georgia the country.
Yeah, right.
And then at the same time, they don't know how to pronounce Arcazzatelli or I can't even say one of the other ones, or Saporavi or some other unfamiliar grape. You've got just a touch of the exotic, but then it's a familiar grape that people can contextualize and they know they like Cab. They know they like Pinot Noir. You know, there's not a lot of South African Pinot Noir, but it's a fantastic, it's something they do very well in the places they do it.
Right. This is a really good point, too, as well, because like we're talking about Cabernet. So maybe Sauvignon Blanc, in all fairness, you have some choices in Sauvignon Blanc to go buy the glass from different parts of the world, right?
Exactly.
But when we say start talking about cabs, when you're looking at that price point, and if you're only looking domestic here in the United States anyway, or even if you're looking old world, it's very difficult to find one of quality, from my perspective anyway, not trying to knock anybody, in that kind of price point. And some stuff that we see in South African wines is you can put these very familiar varietals, but get what, you know, what I will call a cut above as far as the production value of the wine, how it performs, and just overall just quality, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you've got a $20 bill in your pocket and you want a good cab, there's not a lot of places you can turn to, but South Africa is still fulfilling that really with a number of different brands.
Right. Now, as far too, and we are seeing, Jim, I think we've had this conversation, but not maybe so specifically, we are seeing more and more South African wines on the market here in the U.S. now, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, we've seen a wide range. We have, you know, so we got some classic importers who have always been doing very well with the category. It was very exciting to see Cape Classics this year just got the Wine Enthusiast Importer of the Year Award.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which I think is a real acknowledgement of all the work they've done since going back to 1991 or 92, so right when apartheid was ending. But at the same time, we have Meridian Prime or Blue Crane, which is based up in Chicago, a gentleman named Pascal Schilt, who are bringing in a whole bunch of new things that weren't in the market before. Many of them are quite small, young winemakers. So you, the variety of individual wines, SKUs, to put it in trade talk, that's available from South Africa now is higher than ever.
What do the export numbers look like in general? I'm assuming based on this that we're seeing an increased amount of exportation, period, right?
You know what? It's just under about a million cases. It's been flat there for a little while, but this year, beginning of this year, was a little bit flat, but we were actually, compared to our competitors, compared to Argentina, Australia, things like that, we were kind of okay with that. And then it's gotten better because the last numbers I looked at from Gomberg Fredrickson, which is a big trade organization tracking these, had us up, I think, 8%.
Okay.
So it just – so and that's 8% for the year, not just for that month. So I think South Africa is still small enough that the purchasing tends to come in waves. So you have to wait and be patient and look at the big picture instead of looking at month by month.
Right.
So,
that makes sense. How – the U.S. is a sizable market, I know, but what are some of the other important markets for South African wines?
So, well, the U.S. is now the fourth largest market for South African wines, which is actually pretty good. We used to be fifth. We just surpassed Sweden.
Okay.
The U.K. has been number one for a very long time. I think at this point they're about a quarter of the exports, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
Which is lower than they used to be. So it is growing in other markets, but the historical connections mean the U.K. has always been big. And then after that you have the Netherlands and Germany. Again, historical connections. The Netherlands, Germany, until recently was the more Germans visited South Africa than anywhere else in the world. So that tourist connection helped drive business in Germany.
Okay,
so
got it.
Yeah.
So and how many as far as number of wineries are we looking at in South Africa these days?
There's about 560 wineries in South Africa, and
How has that growth gone, Jim, over the past handful of years, roughly? Are we seeing pretty steady growth of wineries?
It's pretty stable.
Okay.
What's changing is the number of growers. So there, if you talk about this, there's a lot of people where the producer is licensing the grapes from a certain farmer.
Working
from a
with
grower.
An independent grower.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Sure.
And there's about 3,100 growers. And that number has been fading a bit. One of the real challenges in South Africa, and this goes to a lot of those European markets, to them, South Africa historically has been a supplier of cheap and cheerful. That's kind of the mantra that goes back in the UK and Holland and Germany especially. So sort of like the role Australia struggled with 10 years ago here in the States, where how much do you pay for an Australian wine? $8. You know, that's when you want to buy an $8 wine, that's a good value. But hard to get people to buy a $20 Australian wine.
Right.
And they're overcoming that image now and making a lot of progress, but that's the South Africa struggle, not here in the U.S., but in those markets.
Okay.
And that means a lot of people who are supplying those markets actually aren't making much money. So as vineyards age out, a lot of times it's more profitable to switch over to an orchard or something like that.
Okay.
And
which is really interesting, and I'm glad you went there because that was going to be my next question.
Right.
Because we see almost... well, in California, for example, the history has been the exact opposite. People started out as, you know, pear farmers. Walnuts might be an exception these days, but a lot of pears and things like that that were pulled out to
right.
plant wine grapes.
Right. Yeah. So, what's with in South Africa? And just to, I mean, actually, South Africa's average price per bottle in the States is higher than a lot of countries. So here, because we don't have a history of trying to compete at that level, that industrial level, and we don't have giant industrial wineries that can have the economies of scale to do that, we've come in at a decent price point. Doesn't mean the wines aren't good value, but it means we don't do a lot of that $8 and $10 wine. We give good value at that $12 to $20 price point and above.
Yeah, so. And people just and people in the industry, if you're listening to this, you know, that falls into what is... I always kind of chuckle sometimes because that's still considered the premium price point. You're thinking, well, $12, that sounds pretty cheap. But
exactly.
Actually, anytime once you get over 10 or so, you're actually in the premium quality. But we're talking about the lower tier
yeah.
of what is called the premium quality.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of performance in that regard.
Exactly.
Now, when Jim, and you were talking about this before, too, where about 3,100 growers, you said about 560 wineries or
that's
so.
Right.
Is that right? Is that model as far as... independent growers, it's something we talk about on the show a lot, so I think a lot of listeners already know where we're coming from, because a lot of people think, oh, estate, it's got to be estate if it's going to be good, and we know that's not necessarily the case. Working with a farmer who knows what the hell they're doing, basically,
yep.
can be very, very smart. Is it a pretty mixed bag, though, there in South Africa, as far as what kind of dominates? Is it more common with the newer wineries, as I might expect, where they're working with independent growers, where some of the older guys are more estate-driven?
It's a real mix. I mean, some of the... Because in the mid-20th century there was a large co-op tradition, well, that was a case of... I mean, a co-op is technically all independent growers that kind of make their wine together. So even some of the big companies still work with a lot of independent growers. But you're definitely right that a lot of the new people are... You know, they've got a custom crush facility, and they're working with a few growers, but they're much more hands-on than that suggests. You know, they're out in those vineyards that they've contracted with on a regular basis. So, and obviously, that's a low capital investment way of getting into the wine industry. So
absolutely.
That's where a lot of young, dynamic people are going to start, and then they're going to start building their own wineries and deciding it's time, hey, maybe we need to buy that vineyard so we have total control of what happens. And
you know, yeah. and I want to be very clear, and Jim is, as I said, we actually talk about this a lot on the show, and I'm my background being coming from having brokered wine grapes,
right.
and my family had a small vineyard and things like that, that we didn't make wine. We sold our grapes to a small family-run winery
yeah.
exclusively. This is not a bad thing. This can actually frequently be a good thing because farmers know how to farm,
yeah.
and it's not that you're not involved in the production process and you're not working with your farmers to actually grow to spec and some things that you're looking for in style. And I think the other key point, too, is that if your winery is located in a particular area and you want to make whatever varietal, say a Chardonnay just for fun, and you're in a place where you can't grow Chardonnay, you got to work with somebody. If you want to make a good wine, you got to work with somebody who can grow Chardonnay where they're supposed to.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like maybe I think there are other agricultural products where you say, well, this year I'm going to plant X and do that. But if you want to change what you're growing, one, you have to have the right conditions for it, and two, you're talking about at least a 3-year process just to rip up vines, let the new vine, you know, plant the new vines and wait 3 years. So it's much better to find someone who's been growing with that grape, is familiar with growing that grape, and is growing it in the right place, and just buy grapes from them if they're selling.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Remind me, Jim, sometime to tell you the story about a few years ago when I was outside of Dallas in Texas for a wine trade show, went to a winery. They were growing about an acre of a hybrid on the property, which was performing well, and then they hired a winemaker from somewhere, and he planted Pinot. And when I was getting a tour of the winery, there was about 3 inches of snow on the ground.
That sounds like it's going to be very unhappy Pinot right there.
And I said to the assistant winemaker, since I'm sort of telling the story now, who was graduated from UC Davis, practical kid, said, I don't know why the hell we did this. And I said, you're going to be lucky to get a yield. And he started to laugh. And I said, let me be clear. I mean a yield, not even a usable yield,
yeah.
a yield on that grape.
No, I think in a lot of places, definitely true in South Africa in the past 10 years, it's don't plant what you want to make. Don't chase the market. Figure out what grows best and what you have and make that.
Yeah.
And then the world is so wide. And with the internet these days, you can get the word out and there's going to be someone who appreciates what you're doing. I mean, to to tout another region right now. I mean, like, look at what's happening in Vermont right now with hybrid varieties.
Yeah.
They said, that's honest what we can grow. You know, trying to plant vinifera up there is a fool's errand.
Yep.
But we can make really great wines from these. And the what they needed to do and what other places that grow hybrids needed to do was figure out how to make the winemaking from hybrids that makes good quality wines.
Yeah,
because that's it's different than working with the vinifera variety.
Yeah, absolutely. So. And you hit the nail right on the head there as far having some experience working with hybrids. Oftentimes the production process needs to be different. Need to ferment cold in certain instances and things like that in ways that you wouldn't treat vinifera. Well, Jim, do me a favor. Tell people where, if they want to explore, we touched on this before, but if they want to explore more about South African wines, if you're interested, if you're in the trade, if you're running a restaurant, where would be some places to go look besides the Wines of South Africa website, of course?
Yeah, so our website's very good, wsa.co.za. Click the multimedia tab, you'll find maps and all that sort of thing. A lot of the British resources are very good. Tim Atkin provides a lot of great coverage. Jancis Robinson has been really, I spoke to her 2 weeks ago, and she can't understand why Americans haven't gotten their head around South African wines, because she was very excited about the category.
And this is the author of the
exactly.
Atlas of Wine.
The Oxford Companion and the World Atlas, yeah. Jamie Good is another blogger who covers South Africa quite extensively and knows it quite well. So those are all really great resources that provide regular coverage. I mean, I think from our domestic magazines, they're all covering, you know, obviously the Wine Advocate, Wine Spectator, Wine Enthusiast. It's actually nice that their head editor now is also their South African reviewer, so that kind of means a lot of enthusiasm for South African wines. So,
got it. Yeah. Great. Well, Jim, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you taking some time. It's always good to see you. And hopefully we're going to be doing that again next year. And we're going to take a little break here, friends, on the show. Come on back. All right, everybody, thanks for listening into the show this week. I appreciate it as always. Quick note on next week's show, friends. We're going to be chatting about the importance, both culturally and economically, of both the hospitality industries and the music industry here in New Orleans. So we're going to have folks representing those various industries, mostly really nonprofit folks connected to that tourism promotion and stuff connected to culture and music here in the town. And a really good show. I'm looking forward to that. So be sure to catch that next week. Real quick, because I know we're a little bit long on this show with our two featured interviews, but our quick parting shot here. We were talking about, you know, all the holiday stuff that we had going on this episode, and even talking about next week's show, in particular the hospitality industry and our friends in the music industry. I'm going to throw that in there. And just want to remind you that so often these people, both musicians that are playing for our entertainment when we're out seeing live music here in New Orleans or wherever we are, and that's so much along with the hospitality industry, that's what drives so much of the economy of New Orleans. But it's also, you know, ways in which we spend a lot of time during the holiday season. And, you know, we're out enjoying ourselves, having a good time. And these people make their money working when we're not working. So, hey, maybe we got some vacation coming up, or it's in the evenings, or it's on the weekends. And these are the people that are taking care of us. And this is also a time of year when they make a lot of, you know, could have a chance to make a good amount of money or a significant percentage of what their annual income is during these busy times. I'm speaking specifically to New Orleans to a degree, but I think this applies everywhere. So when you're out and about, you know, remember to take care of those that are entertaining us, meaning the musicians, and those that are waiting and serving us in bars and restaurants. Make sure you tip generously. Always be polite. They're working, as I said, when we're not. Oftentimes, these people have to forego seeing their families on the holidays because they have to work also for our entertainment and our care and feeding, no pun intended. So just be mindful of that and be generous with those folks and be thankful that those folks are out there working hard to take care of us, make us happy, keep us entertained, and keep a smile on our face during the holiday season. So that's it, friends. That's our parting shot. We'll see you next week. Here's to you.